listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 38th installment of our conversations with Professor Luciana Bone about the history of the Soviet Union. And we come into the maybe one of the most important events of that history, with perhaps a single event that set the course toward self-destruction, into play. It took perhaps 30 to 35 years for it to completely actualize. But this is the so-called secret speech by Nikita Khrushchev in 1956 to the Communist Party of the Soviet Union.
So we decided to talk about Nikita Khrushchev's secret report to the CPSU. And I'll start with usual preambles. So in the West, we have followed for 90 years a kind of dominant anti-Stalin paradigm. And the question is, where does it come from? How did it arise? How did it develop? What did it lead to? In essence, the anti-Stalin paradigm served the West very well to attack the Soviet Union and socialism, because it portrayed Stalin as the monster. And so so he's depicted as a monster, and by this paradigm could only function, that is, that this monster could only function in a nation of stupid robots. So all socialists are robots, and they were ruled by a monster. So over almost 90 years, the political discourse in the West has been saturated by attacks against Stalin. The attacks took off from the many books by Leon Trotsky, who accused Stalin of having betrayed the revolution.
Right.
After the Second World War came the Cold War, which was intellectually driven or guided by Hannah Arendt's book on totalitarianism, where she presented the idea that Stalin and Hitler were twins, evil twins, who constructed totalitarian empires. Hannah Arendt's book, I think, Totalitarianism, came after the 1956 speech that we are about to discuss.
Mm-hmm.
Because the most devastating attack of all on Stalin naturally came from the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, whose leader at the time was Nikita Khrushchev.
Yep.
In his so-called secret report to the 20th Congress of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union,
right,
in 1956. And I just want to say,
right,
what happened. I think the Congress opened on the 12th of February and the secret report took place on the 25th of February. The opening speech by Khrushchev, to which the Soviet delegates as well as international delegates were present and invited. That speech, of the opening speech, took 7 hours. But what people noted, that is representative of the Communist Party and delegates of the world, Communist Party of the world, noticed that there were no pictures of Stalin in the hall. And in that speech, he presented some ideological novelties that I will get to later, but among them was the idea that the class struggle was over and that that the West and the East should live in peace, etc. There was, even in the 7-hour speech, an ideological turnaround. But the secret report that was at the conclusion of the Congress, which was the night between 24th and 25th, to which only the Soviet delegates were invited, and which took 4 hours, and this. There is a little, I can't quite determine whether the foreign delegates were invited or not. All I know is that they were eventually read the speech, but not given copies. But there is a bit of dispute over this. I haven't checked very thoroughly. At any rate, there was a great deal of hush-hush about it. And in fact, the State Department, the CIA got a hold of it, and the State Department or the New York Times or whoever published it in June of 1956.
Yeah.
That's the kind of, factual background.
Yeah.
In the secret report, which apparently he had consulted other members, he accused Stalin of having established a cult of personality, of having persecuted unjustly thousands of innocent communists. He never really mentioned how many, but those who followed did. Those who followed him and his report. Now, except for the Chinese Communist Party, the Albanian Communist Party, the Greek and Portuguese Communist Parties, every other Communist Party of the world accepted and adopted this vision of Stalin by Khrushchev.
Because it came from Moscow. That's really the reality
because
of it.
Exactly.
It came from Moscow. That was the authoritative center of the global
of
revolution.
Communism.
Yep, of the communist global communist revolution.
And the cradle of the socialist, the communist revolution.
That's right.
It came from Moscow. And as we said before, Khrushchev had not consulted with any of the secretaries of the parties of the world communist parties. This was done without consulting any of the fraternal parties, as Mao pointed out and we mentioned last week.
And the real irony here is this. The reason that the Soviet Union is the center generally of the global communist movement is that it's the first successful communist revolution that has been constructing communism and
yes.
is a global power and is offering assistance to others in doing, you know, performing that task around the world. In other words, the deeds of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union place it at the center of the global communist movement. This primarily happens if you're talking about the period from 1917 until 1956, that's 40 years, 39 years, the bulk of that was while Stalin was at the head of the Soviet leadership. The critique that is brought against Stalin and against the party during that period of time, and really against the entire society, is that it was behaving exactly in the way that Trotsky had said it was behaving back in almost 1905. That wasn't true, that this distorted monster that was being constructed of bureaucrats and all kinds of other evils that were anti-revolutionary and anti-worker, that this thing had placed the Soviet Union at the center of the leadership of the communist movement, and it was now being denounced under the same terms that its enemies had denounced it all the way up to that point, and now from a position of authority.
That's right. Now, just let's take a look at what 1956 means. Not only I have to add that he was very careful. Khrushchev was very careful to say that the deformation, the monstrosity that Stalin had created, was not due to the Bolshevik Revolution or the Bolsheviks. In other words, all right. This started with Stalin, but as you point out, though Khrushchev seemed to defend the Leninist Revolution, the Bolshevik Leninist Revolution, by even saying that the class struggle was over.
Right.
That was anti-Stalinist.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, this is what Trotsky did that, too. As soon as Lenin died, suddenly Lenin was
God. He became a Leninist.
Yeah, he became a Leninist. When Lenin was alive,
Leninist.
He was... Yeah, exactly. And when Lenin was alive, Lenin was the enemy. And and or overstating himself, and or cult of personality, and or whatever other evil they can impute to Lenin, and really to the society. Khrushchev was forced, of course, to do exactly what you said, because if he says all of these things I just mentioned are true, and consequently the child of this behavior is illegitimate, people will say, then why am I listening to you? Because you are that child. And so what he had to do was, on the one hand, kill his parents. On the other hand, say, I am not, and never have been, an orphan.
That's right. Yeah. And if we look at 1956, let's see what the global situation is. We have just concluded in 1954, that is, Indochina has just... Vietnam, just kicked France out. The Algerian independence movement is beginning. The Korean War ended, in 1952, 53?
Yeah.
Stalin helped. Russia, Soviet Union helped these independence movements.
That's right. And Bandung. So Bandung, you had
socialism constructed in one country, but that country was able to help independence movement to kick off the imperialist, Western imperialist yoke.
And those forces were gathering. You had the Bandung Conference in 1955, essentially the beginning of the Third World Movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, in reality, just to remind what we've been discussing throughout this conversation, Stalin built the first socialist society and built it on the wreck left behind by imperialist intervention and civil war. He was responsible for ending Nazi imperialism, and in doing so, he preserved socialism and helped extend its foundations into Eastern Europe while it lasted. Yep. And it lasted until Khrushchev started this counter-revolution. He was the principal theoretician of socialism after the death of Lenin, and he guided the Soviet Union during the period of industrialization, of collectivization of agriculture, of the defense against the encirclement, the imperialist encirclement, and the fascist invasion. He guided the reconstruction after the devastation of the Second World War. But all of this is just thrown into the black hole of vilification with the anti-Stalin paradigm, which Khrushchev started in the secret report. Now, what he said so much, I mean, we're talking about 4 hours. So the litany of Khrushchev is familiar to all the West. They're educated into this. The litany goes like this. He was guided by a diffident, paranoid, pathological nature, a suspicious nature, and by an overwhelming desire for personal power. I'm just going to do the litany. So this is what people believe, and they, you know, all over the world who are not communists, they believe this, that he himself unleashed the bureaucratic violence that is against the leaders of the party. By the way, Khrushchev was on board at the time, and though he says that Stalin launched the bureaucratic violence, he was part of it, and he knows damn well that and he knows very well that it wasn't a personal decision. In fact, in the case of Bukharin, Stalin was probably the most moderate of the people within the party who were asking for his condemnation. That he launched a mass repression and terror, especially against the leaders of the party, that he persecuted thousands and thousands of innocent persons. He never mentioned beyond thousands and thousands. He never mentioned the number. That Stalin violated socialist laws, legality, etc., and then instilled fear in the whole country. Khrushchev accused Stalin of assassinating Sergei Kirov, which was never proven. Even Gorbachev tried to find out and found nothing. Now, Sergei Kirov was personal friend of Stalin, and just to remind people, Sergei Kirov was the party secretary in Leningrad, and was a very close friend of Stalin, and was probably, would, if anything happened to Stalin, or in an election, if Kirov was likely to be the next, you know, the person after Stalin. So I'm getting ahead of myself, sorry. Let me go on with the litany.
It's okay.
Khrushchev accused Stalin of assassinating Sergei Kirov, the popular party secretary of Leningrad, and the motive for killing Kirov was to use the killing of Kirov as an excuse to round up and eliminate all his political rivals in the party, and that the three Moscow trials and the military trial of Tukhachevsky were a farce. The indicted, he didn't say he didn't rehabilitate them. He didn't say they were innocented, but he said their death sentences were an error. So, in fact, almost. Those are some, only some of the charges. In addition, in his speech, not the secret speech, but the general speech, the 7-hour speech that opened the Congress, what Khrushchev said, deviated from Marxist-Leninist ideology because he sustained that, because he said that the class struggle, as I mentioned before, had ended in the Soviet Union and generally he affirmed in the 20th Congress that after the taking power, class struggle had been overcome. Now, this is really an evaluation that disagrees with historical experiences right. of the bourgeois revolution, of the Paris Commune, and conflicts with what Marx and Engels, Lenin and Stalin said. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sorry, I'm going on.
No.
I'm going on.
Because take the next 35 years up to 1991. Certainly the class struggle did not end in the Soviet Union because the workers' government was overthrown by the bourgeoisie.
That's right. So, he was doing it.
Right.
I mean, as he was saying
exactly.
that the class struggle was over, his own class,
right.
which was a class, he was way back in 1929, when the party was deciding which road to take to communism, to socialism, there were three possibilities: Trotsky's permanent revolution, Bukharin's gradualism, you know, little by little, and Stalin's own proposal, very detailed, of the socialism in one country, starting with collectivization of agriculture, industrialization, defense of the state, and distribution of some of building of schools, you know, beginning to build socialism. So
right.
there were three possibilities, and the one Bukharin sustained was the gradualist, the slow way, and also privatization, you know, some private, sort of a mixed social, so a kind of social democracy Bukharin was
right.
was advocating. Khrushchev, now, what happened with Gorbachev is the rehabilitation of Bukharin. So we have a line from, well, really from Trotsky through Khrushchev, the Cold War, to Gorbachev, to the dissolution of the Soviet Union. That goes straight from, I mean, and the core point, the core moment is this secret speech, secret report that Khrushchev made in 1956.
Right.
In fact, in saying that class struggle was over, I lost my outline.
In saying that the class struggle was over.
Whereas since we know that from the end of the Second World War, the United States and the other nation, the other capitalist nation, did everything they could in their power to increase the struggle against the Soviet Union, well, and even within, internally, within the Soviet Union, which Khrushchev, in my view, and in view of many others, facilitated to promote its disintegration.
Well, and so, the obverse was true also. If you look at, for example, the internal developments in the United States in the post-war period, it is very difficult to come to the conclusion that the class war had ended in the United States. when you had anyone mentioned socialism or communism, they were in front of HUAC and or driven out of their jobs and or communities.
They're not called purges.
Yeah. But right, they didn't call it a purge. They made it an illegal act, and they you know, there was a violation of the Smith Act or, you know, whatever. But it was clear on the entire global chessboard, from the games that were being played in Washington for domestic purposes in the United States and for the Western European countries where policy was being made in Washington, all the way across the globe, where you had the entire shaping up of developments in the colonies with the anti-colonial movement rising, and you know, the Western colonial powers suppressing that. If that's not a class struggle, what is that?
What is it? That's right. So he wasn't an internationalist. He didn't. How can you say the class struggle is over at the same time that Algeria is rising up?
Right.
Vietnam has just kicked off France and is being tormented by the United States.
Right.
I mean,
Congo, you know, Bandung, you know, across the globe. You know, we're 2 years away from a Cuban revolution. And by the way, we're a few months away from the first satellite of the planet Earth, the first successful orbiting of the Earth by a human structure, which came out of a socialist country. And in addition to that, in the backdrop from like the April of 1944 forward, you had the plan developing in Washington to drop, as soon as they had 250 atomic bombs, to bomb the Soviet Union into oblivion. That was not because they considered them an international threat, as with the Germans, since they allied with the Soviet Union against the Germans, but rather the class character of the Soviet Union that was the driving force there, obviously.
Yeah. Now, to say that the class struggle was over was practical treason.
Right.
I mean, it was treason to everything that Marx and Lenin, Marxist-Leninist, the government of the Soviet Union had stood for.
Right. Well, it's being proclaimed from the center of the leadership of the class struggle. Okay.
This is unbelievable. And the imagine the rank and file, let's say in Italy, which I know best.
Right.
All of a sudden, the leader, so Togliatti, Palmiro Togliatti, the leader of the Italian Communist Party, was in Moscow, and he had to come back and sort of try to modify, you know, Khrushchev's position, but stood with it. This kind of compromise began that confused the rank and file. What? 1 minute you tell us that Stalin is the father of socialism and is our, you know, symbol, etc., and now you're telling us he's a criminal,
right? And I mean, what all kinds of things flowed from that. This is the kind created the kind of ideological confusion that resulted in what they called Euro-communism in the 60s and 70s.
Yep.
And the divisions, not just the first effect, of course, was to drive a major split down the middle, because you mentioned on one side you had the USSR and essentially the Warsaw Pact countries. On the other side, China. okay, with
yes.
half the population yeah. living under yeah, socialist he, government, he, which
yeah,
split
that,
off.
That speech was, murder to communism.
Yep.
It fed division, confusion, cynicism, demoralization, and finally complacency. It brought disaster to the communist movement, to the world communist movement, and in the long run, to socialism in the Soviet Union.
Yep.
So now it was very hard to recover from this 1956 blow. In the 60s and 70s, the Khrushchev demonization, vilification of Stalin was followed by writers such as Robert Conquest, yeah. Roy Medvedev, yeah. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, and yeah. others
and others,
the accusation
yep.
of Khrushchev
yep.
and affirm that the number of the victims of Stalin had been over 60 million people
right.
and that not a single part of the Soviet life, not the ideology of science, of art, escaped the corrosive impact of Stalinism.
Yeah, that's right.
So in this way, anti-Stalinism transfigured itself, became anti-Sovietism.
And it was very successful in doing that, and remains so to this day in to a large degree. And we're going to pick it up here and explore this a little deeper next week, because it goes to the essence of this question. The moral authority of a global movement that demands economic justice for the entire human race was eroded and compromised severely by this public relations campaign, which is in essence what Khrushchev was leading.
A counter-revolution.
Okay, and which was the public relations campaign of a counter-revolution. That's correct. And what it did was enable all of the things that enabled the deconstruction of the socialist economies over time. Mm-hmm. And we're going to go back to that next week. So thank you very much, Luciano.
Very good. Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Worlds Apart. As a popular American song goes, there is no justice in the world, and the Palestinians may know it better than anyone else. Expelled from the land, fed with empty statehood promises for 70 years, and now shot at and killed en masse for the sake of providing security for Israel. Is that likely to prompt any international response beyond the standard condemnations? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Saeb Erekat, Secretary General of the Palestine Liberation Organization. Mr. Erekat, it's good to talk to you at this critical moment. Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Now, first of all, let me express our deep felt condolences and just as deeply felt rage at the mass killing on the Gaza border. Is there anything at this point that you can do to stop it?
First of all, I appreciate your kindness and your understanding of the situation and your condolences to the Palestinian people. We have witnessed a real massacre. 64 people were killed, totally unarmed, in their land. None of them crossed Israel. And then the Israeli army killed 64 and wounded 2,500 in the West Bank and Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
And the line that we hear from Israel is that Israel defend itself. I don't know, defend itself against what and against whom. And then the United States. Now, Nikki Haley, the ambassador of the United States, really is becoming to be the spokesperson of the Israeli government. And this American administration is really throwing this region down the path of extremism, violence, and counter violence and bloodshed.
Let's not diminish it only to the United States as Israel. Obviously, there is also an international community, and you cannot say that it has entirely turned a blind eye to what has happened. A number of countries have recalled their ambassadors. The UN human rights spokesman called the Monday violence appalling and deadly. The Europeans, including the Russians, expressed condemnation. Do you think, though, this reaction is proportionate to what has happened? As you pointed out, more than 60 people killed on one day and more than 2,700 injured.
Well, first of all, we appreciate the support of the international community. We support those countries who stood tall and stood shoulder to shoulder with the Palestinian people in their moment of sadness and darkness, who stood tall to condemn the massive Israeli massacres and war crimes being committed here. And that's, I think, the majority of the nations of Earth have expressed their condemnation of such act. Then, after the condemnation, what do we do about it? What do we do about it? Now, since March 30th till now, we have 104 Palestinians killed, mostly women and children, 5,000 wounded. What do we do tomorrow? Israel feels immune. And at the end of the day, we have done everything humanly possible as Palestinians, as a leadership here, to achieve peace with Israel. We have recognized Israel's right to exist on the 67 lines. We have accepted the two-state solution. We have worked so hard with the quartet, Americans, Russian, European Union, and the United Nations to achieve peace. But the Israeli government refused the two-state solution, refused the creation of a Palestinian state, continued to build settlements and dictation on the ground. And then comes the United States administration to support all the Israeli moves and steps and to dictate on us, thus throwing international diplomacy towards chaos, lawlessness, and anarchy.
Now, Mr. Erekat, as I said in my introduction, this is a hugely, hugely unfair world. And this is not the first time that the Israelis resorted to such disproportionate and, in my view, callous violence against your people. But let me repeat my question again. Do you think there's anything that other countries can do to change that? What exactly you would like to see Russia, the European Union, China, any of your supporters in the Arab world to do at this point?
I would like the people who stand with international law, the countries that stand to defend international law, like Russia, China, the European Union, the organizations like the UN and other countries, to hold Israel accountable. They cannot continue business as usual with Israel. They cannot continue receiving Israeli prime ministers in their capitals. They cannot continue their trade with Israel as long as they do these things. Israel must be held accountable. If any country on earth does this to its people and to the people, to their neighbors, what would the international community do? Now, this government feels immune, feels that people, khalas, one statement condemning, saying it's bad, and then in the Security Council we have an American veto, in the General Assembly we have resolutions that are never implemented. So if you want me to be very frank, I want these nations, because to stand tall and hold the Israeli government accountable. Now, we have made a referral for the International Criminal Court. We want the help of the members of the International Court, Criminal Court, to help us open an official investigation in these war crimes against the Israeli Prime Minister and Defense Minister and other Israeli officials. We have a case now in the Human Rights Council calling for an investigation committee. We want the support of the international community to send and compel Israel to accept this investigation committee to begin its work. That's what we need. But then, you know, if Israel feels that they can continue building settlements, massacring Palestinians, and then it's business as usual, and their occupation and their demolishing of homes and collective punishment, and then business as usual. If I say this, people will tell me, oh, this is not realistic. How can we be part of making peace while we treat Israel like this? Israel has a government that is non-partner. We don't have a partner in Israel for peace anymore. This Israeli government is there to destroy the two-state solution and to destroy hope for peace.
Mr. Ericott, you made it clear on a number of occasions that you do not see the United States as an honest or independent peace broker. And I think many people, at least in Moscow, would totally agree to that. But with the United States absent, who can possibly compel? And this is a painful question, but I have to ask you, who can possibly compel Israel to negotiate in good faith or even cease doing what it's doing?
That's up to the international community. That's up to the moral standards of nations. If they want this region, because who's benefiting now from such actions of Israel and the United States? The United States is not only not a partner. They cannot be a partner. They are not a broker. They have taken the seats of Netanyahu. They are dictating the solution. They are throwing this region towards lawlessness. Extremists in this region have been strengthened and provided the ammunition by these American and Israeli decisions and actions more than any time before. Moderates in the Arab world, people like me, have been destroyed. So the nations of the world, if they can't get through the Security Council, if they can't get through the International Criminal Court, if they can't do anything about their trade, that means you're telling the Arab people the only way for you is to use violence. The only way for you is to support extremism. And that's what we've been fighting against as Arabs. Because we want to live and let live. We want human rights. We want human rights, women's rights, democracy, the rule of law. We want peace. But with such action, such fascism, such apartheid being exercised by Israel, and Israel getting away with it, I think this is opening the gate of hell in this region.
Speaking about who is benefiting from it, I think there is a deliberate effort on the Israeli side now to paint all the Gaza protesters as a Hamas mob, which they clearly weren't. Having said that, do you think there's any truth to the argument that Hamas may find these demonstrations and the ensuing violence a welcome distraction, allowing it to refocus the growing frustration with that same group in Gaza into anger against Israel?
Well, I don't, you know, this is the Israeli argument. All the time, Israel is defending itself. How many Israelis were wounded? How many Israelis were killed? How many Israelis were threatened? None. Hamas has nothing to do with this demonstration. There are people from all spectrum of Palestinian civic society. Your reporters are there. Did you see a single Palestinian in these demonstrations with a gun, with a weapon, with anything? Nothing. Women and children and men and all from civic societies, from all Palestinian factions, from all parts of the world. But then Israel's line is that Iran, Hamas, Hezbollah threatened destruction of Israel. They're destroying. They're hitting Syria. They're hitting Lebanon. They're killing the Palestinians. And then they claim to be the victims. And that's the irony. That's the irony of fascism. We have seen such pretext given by all fascists who went throughout this history. Israel is killing and destroying a Palestinian civilian population under occupation, under Israeli occupation, under international law. Civilians should be protected, and the international community must move in the direction of providing international protection for Palestinians.
Mr. Ericott, as you mentioned, we do have reporters on the ground, and most of them are attest to the very indeed peaceful nature of this protest. They say that given how many people have participated in the demonstrations, they were actually surprised how placid those demonstrations were on the Palestinian side. But I also have to know that there have been reports of some young men bringing knives and fence cutters to the demonstrations. There were also reports of calls over the loudspeakers to burst through the fence. And I just wonder, what do you think would be the proportionate reaction from the Israeli side to those kind of actions?
Let's say that people cross the line, okay? Which, by the way, there is no line because Israel did not define its borders yet.
But you know there is a fence there, and there's Israeli soldiers guarding that fence.
The fence is self-imposed, is self-created. Israel has not declared its borders yet. That's the question. But when we saw the refugees coming from the Middle East towards Europe, tens of thousands. Did you hear of any people being killed in Russia or in Holland or in Germany or in France or in Britain? Yeah, if Palestinians cross the line, you can arrest them. You can arrest them. You don't have to open gunfire. And we have pictures of Israeli soldiers killing our kids and our boys and girls and then celebrating, clapping, express their happiness. These are war crimes. These are murderers. I cannot accept any pretext other than saying that they're defending. How can they defend themselves? To use the pretext of such massacres, I think the message is very clear. I think the message is telling Palestinians, we're here to stay as your occupiers. We're going to blockade Gaza. We're going to continue our control in the West Bank. We're going to continue our settlements. We have the full support of this American administration, the Trump administration, which is really throwing the whole world toward chaos and lawlessness and extremism in its actions. And then those nations, there are 194 nations on earth. Not a single nation without a problem in its social demographic fabric or geographic fabric. So if we're going to go on the path of lawlessness that Trump is pursuing, the result will be chaos, lawlessness, the rule of the jungle, violence and counter-violence and bloodshed and extremism. Is that what we want? Is that what Europe wants? What Russia wants? What China wants?
Mr. Erica, this is obviously not what we want, but unfortunately the world has been allowing this for a number of years, if not decades already. Let me ask you one very specific question on the May 14th events, because the protests in on the Gaza border, let's call it border, around the Gaza fence, had been ongoing for more than a month. There were victims and casualties before, dozens of people killed, and yet the majority of the casualties occurred on that specific day of Israel's founding and the opening of the Israeli of the American embassy in Jerusalem. Do you find this fact that the majority of casualties occurred on May 14th, a tragic, sad coincidence, or do you indeed think that the Israeli army was tasked with being more forceful with using live fire on that specific occasion?
Well, exactly. Yani, the Palestinians, President Trump came, there is a fire, and then he poured fuel on the fire. The Americans, instead of being the firemen, they became the arsonists. And that's the meaning of the opening of the embassy in East Jerusalem. It's like establishing a new settlement outpost in occupied territories. And then the message from Israel, okay, we have the United States here, and look at what we're doing. We're massacring Palestinians. And then in the United Nations, there are two Israeli ambassadors, one named Dannon and one named Haley, and we will blame the Palestinians. We'll blame the Palestinians, we will export fear and so on. And I don't think that the international community has a neon in their forehead saying stupid. Because the lack of reaction of the international community is a real threat, is a real threat to the stability and security of all nations. Extreme blood will breed blood, violence will breed violence. Desperation will lead to desperate acts. And what Israel is doing now in destroying a Palestinian life, social life, economic life, making people hopeless, what will they be creating? I'm a father of four, a grandfather of seven. I don't want them to be suicide bombers. I want them to be like your children in Russia, like the children in Sweden, like the children in the United States. I want them to be normal people. With such massacres, with such crimes, and Israel getting away with it, what you're doing is totally paving the way for the gates of hell to open in this region.
Well, Mr. Erekat, let me stop you there. We have to take a very short break, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Saeb Erekat, Secretary General of the Palestine Liberation Organization. Mr. Erekat, there is some effort on the part of the former U.S. administration, the Obama administration, to try to convince its European allies to essentially hold on for a few years until Trump is voted out of office. You know, this idea that one day normality will return. I wonder if that is the perspective that you take as well, that this current American predisposition, which is clearly harmful and unfair to your cause, that it is only temporary.
Well, look, we had meetings with the Trump administration in 2017 35 times, including four summits between our president and President Trump. And I held personally 31 other meetings with them as negotiations. We gave them every possible chance. with their decision in declaring Israel as capital of Israel, they disqualified themselves from any role in the peace process. We will not sit with them. They're not partners. They're not only biased. They're adopting the Israeli position of dictation and not negotiations. And, you know, once Franklin D. Roosevelt said the office, the White House, is an office of international morality. An office of international morality needs giant statesmen, not real estate agents. This administration cannot be a partner. And of course, our only option is to stay on this land and to be in this land. Today, between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean, we are the majority. As Palestinian Arabs, Palestinian Christian and Muslim Arabs, we're 50.9%. Jews are 49.1%. What are they going to do with us? Other than creating extremism, and then, you know, when violence spread and people are being killed on both sides, then Israel will say, oh, these people have it in their DNA, they're terrorists and so on. I have devoted 25 years of my life in negotiations with Israel to save lives of Israelis and Palestinians, to live and let live. We have recognized Israel's right to exist. We have accepted a Palestinian state with East Jerusalem as capital to live side by side in peace and security with the state of Israel in the 1967 lines. What did Israel do in return? More settlements, more dictations, more killing, more murders, more siege, more closures, more collective punishments, home demolitions. All these actions are being done in 2018 by a member of the UN. And they call it the only democracy in the world. This is it's fascism. Yani never in the history of South Africa, darkest hours of apartheid, were blacks prevented to use roads white were using. Today there are in the West Bank and East Jerusalem roads we cannot use as Palestinians. And such diseases as bigotry and racism, once they inflict underneath our skins of any kind, of any race, of any religion, we had a tendency to justify it. Sometimes we give sociological, psychological, economic, sexual explanations. And now Israel is using the pretext security to justify its apartheid system being created in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip. And this must stop. And this, we will stand up. We will not depart. This is our land. And we will defend ourselves.
Mr. Arakat, let me ask you one more question. I know that you believe that Trump's announcement and his decision to move the American embassy to Jerusalem was essentially the end of the two-state solution. That's at least what you said on record. And I also heard you say that Trump's decision would force the Palestinians to strive for quote-unquote historic Palestine from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea, which is another way of saying that you two not only reject the two-state solution, but you actually don't recognize Israel's right to exist on those territories. I understand the emotions behind that statement. I understand them. But do you think it can bring your people any good in practical terms?
Look, what I said our only option, is a two-state solution. Our option is to live and let live. Our option is for the state of Israel, which we recognized on the 1967 lines, to live side by side in peace and security with the state of Palestine. That's what we said. Now, Israel did not recognize the Palestinian state, refused to stop settlements, and so on. So we're left with two options. If Israel is destroying the two-state solution, and Benjamin Netanyahu personally is in office for the last 9 years destroying the two-state solution, and now Trump came to help him in order to bury the two-state solution, we're left with two options. One is Netanyahu's option, one state, two systems, apartheid. This will not be accepted to us. The second option is one state, equal rights for Jews, Muslims, and Christians to live together. That's a very civilized solution, but the Israelis will never accept it. So if Israel destroys the two-state solution, and if the option of apartheid is not doable for the Palestinians, and if the option of one state, equal rights, is not doable for the Israelis, what would this leave Palestinians and Israelis with?
I think this narrative of historic Palestine is definitely becoming more popular among the Palestinian officials. Just the other day, Mahmoud Abbas said that Palestine is for the Palestinians. It is not, as the Jews claim, the land of their ancestors. So he does seem to be questioning Israel's right to exist on those lands. And I wonder if that does not make it easier for Israel to paint you as anti-Semitic rejectionists.
President Mahmoud Abbas went to the Security Council in February 20th, 2018. And in his speech last week at the Palestine National Council, reiterated our commitment to the two-state solution, where the state of Palestine, with East Jerusalem as its capital, will live side by side in peace and security with the state of Israel. And he called for convening of an international conference. And he was willing to come to Moscow upon the invitation of President Putin to meet with Prime Minister Netanyahu. And Prime Minister Netanyahu refused the invitation of President Putin twice, not once, twice. And President Abbas accepted. We are with the two-state solution. We recognized Israel. Israel did not recognize us. Since 1988, we have accepted resolutions 242 and 338 and recognized Israel. And since 1988, Israel has done nothing but to dictate settlements on the land that's supposed to be a Palestinian state. That's the reality. That's the reality. We never abandoned the two-state solution. The two-state solution is our line, is our vision, is to live and let live, because we know, we're realists. This is the only way for Palestinians and Israelis, is to have two states to live side by side in peace and security next to each other. Now, who's destroying the two-state solution? Who's building settlements in the supposed to be a Palestinian state on the hour every hour? Who's dictating the fate of Jerusalem other than Trump and Netanyahu? Who's using the collective punishment and military means? Can you solve a political problem with military means? You can't. You can't. So all these things, our position is that we have recognized Israel and this stands. Israel refuses the two-state solution. President Trump never mentioned two states. He mentioned it in the context that if both parties agreed, he gave a veto to Netanyahu. The administrations of the United States since 1967 considered East Jerusalem as occupied territories. Now they said we recognize Jerusalem as defined by the government of Israel. That means they have abandoned their line that East Jerusalem is occupied territory. So what do you do in such case? I think this region is being thrown to the hands of extremists. I think Arab moderates are being destroyed. And I think this is the intention, the strategy. So they can say, Israel can say, oh, we're the only democracy. We want peace, but we don't have a partner for peace. And nobody will ask them, but you had a partner for peace who recognized you since 1988. And they negotiated with you for 25 years. And you did not move one inch to announce that you accept the two-state solution, or you want to recognize the Palestinian state, or stop settlements, or stop the collective punishment.
Mr. Erekat, we've talked about Israel and the United States, but I think it's also evident that one of your former strong backers in the Arab world, Saudi Arabia, is also, is no longer there for you, if I may put it that way. I'm sure you've heard about this leaked conversation of the Crown Prince, Saudi Crown Prince, reportedly suggesting that the Palestinians should take what's on offer or shut up. What's your reaction to that?
This is absolutely baseless. This is not true. Last night, I was with the president when he received a phone call from His Majesty King Salman bin Abdulaziz of Saudi Arabia. He called for an emergency session tomorrow for the Arab foreign minister. They pledged to fully support us. They denounced and condemned the Trump decision. And this is false accusation. They're trying to tell Palestinians that you're alone. That's a lie. We have a common Arab position. Arab may differ with each other over Syria, over Iraq, over Libya, over Yemen. But when it comes to Palestine, Arabs are united. The last summit held in Riyadh, King Salman of Saudi Arabia said it's the summit of Jerusalem in condemnation of Trump's decision. That is the truth. That's the truth. There is no Arab country that doesn't support us, fully supporting us. And that's the truth. So all these lies being spread by Netanyahu, that trying to say that they see the geopolitics of the region, that Iran is the threat, and we joined with Saudi Arabia, and we joined with the Emirates, with this, with that, that's totally, total lies. Netanyahu's occupation is destabilizing all Arab countries.
Well, Mr. Erekat, we have to leave it there. I really, really appreciate you taking time to talk to us today. And I also invite our viewers to keep this conversation going in our social media pages. I hope to see you again. Same place, same time here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.